Hello, this is Alton Banks from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. So we begin this week's Triangle Business Journal by a look at the biz page. And as you know, there are several short articles on the biz page, and this first one is called, in the off-and-running section, Young Entrepreneur Honored. Congrats to Christian Bell, a student at Raleigh's Millbrook High, who dreams of selling his own line of clothing. A supporter of the Daniel Center for Math and Science helped him design and trademark a logo for his T-shirt company, and he wants more mentors, too. Bell entered the second Raleigh Children's Business Fair at North Hills. When I grow up, I want to be financially independent, he says, and I thought being an entrepreneur was the best way to go. And under the heading of Getting Fit comes the article, Bring the Exercise to You. Here at Biz, we're the type to keep work, home, and exercise in separate silos, but it looks like that trend may be changing. In Holly Springs, Jeff Volkman bought a franchise from Gym Guys, which has locations around the U.S., according to its website. The idea is a van with more than 300 pieces of equipment. It brings the trainer to you for one-hour sessions. We virtually bring the gym to the client, Volkman says. Volkman from Minnesota has coached hockey for years and now coaches the hockey team at UNC Chapel Hill. I was looking for a franchise in line with my passion, he says. He says he has three trainers lined up and will launch the franchise, the first in North Carolina, in November. Along those same lines, Sandra Malm, who graduated from Wake Forest University with a business degree in 2012, is looking to take yoga to the workplace with Awake Company Yoga, where the studio environment can be perceived as exclusive, Malm says. Office yoga opens the practice to folks who might otherwise not make time to commute to a studio, budget for yoga, or feel comfortable arriving alone to their first class. Interesting concepts, and makes Biz feel a bit guilty after eating so much Captain Crunch. And under the heading PacStar comes the article, NC State's Thurl Bailey back in town for Shelton event. NC State University fans will get a chance to hear from a familiar name when basketball star Thurl Bailey speaks November the 3rd at the Shelton Leadership Forum at the McKimmon Center. Bailey led the Wolfpack to the 1983 national title before a long career in the NBA. The forum is named for NC State graduate Hugh Shelton, the former chief of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and looks to install values-based leadership. In the heading of On the Record comes this quote from Governor Cooper. The quote is, "It will take an extraordinary place to attract Amazon's HQ2, and it's been exciting to have four North Carolina communities put their best efforts forward to bring these jobs to our state. Local elected, business, and civic leaders are proud of their communities and are working together to demonstrate the kind of talent, creative real estate, cost of living, and quality of life that any employer should find irresistible. The cooperation and enthusiasm we're seeing reinforces that we're the best place for Amazon and will make North Carolina more attractive to employers in the future." And under the heading, Ouch, comes the article, Clayton Buildings Are Quite a Big Hit with Drivers. Just before 3 p.m. on October the 23rd, a driver with a medical issue accidentally crashed his car into a Pep Boys on Highway 70 business in Clayton. No one was hurt, and the damage was only cosmetic. Now, usually Biz wouldn't pay much attention to this, but only a few days earlier, and just a few miles down the same road, a van plowed into a Clayton pizza joint. No injuries there either, but the driver was booked for driving under the influence, and the damage at Big Cheese Pizza was much more extensive. Stacy Beard, public information officer at the town of Clayton, said, "With Manny Moe and Jack, the Pep Boys mascots, being our second building in just a few days, we're hoping these things don't come in threes." "Well, this would technically be the third if you consider the car that smashed into the Clayton Mart in August," she quipped. And finally, under the heading of Get a Lift, it's time to accelerate. Looking to get that small business off the ground? It's time for Accelerate Experience 2017, a one-day event focused on education, support, and networking for entrepreneurs and small business owners. EXE 2017 is being held at the North Carolina Biotechnology Center on November 3rd and will feature a number of speakers, resources, and interactive activities from local organizations. Education, networking, and connection are vital elements to success for entrepreneurs and small business owners, says Diana Needham, co-director of Accelerate Experience 2017. Wake Tech Center for Entrepreneurship is the program's educational sponsor this year, and Dress for Success Triangle is the community nonprofit partner. The keynote speaker is business coach Pamela Bruner, who will be presenting Businesswoman 2.0, the new must-haves to create extraordinary results in your business. EXE 2017 expects to host 170 guests. Now moving on to the On Life Sciences page, comes a couple of articles, one in legal and one in technology. So under the legal heading comes the article, Gen X Class Actions Pile Up in Cape Fear Region. Concern over Gen X and its presence in Wilmington's main drinking water source, the Cape Fear River, has led to another pair of class action lawsuits. Earlier this month, the law offices of James Scott Farron, based in Durham, along with the Hannon Law Firm out of Denver, filed a class action lawsuit against DuPont and Spinout Chemours over the release of the toxic chemical Gen X into the Cape Fear River. While the first class action was filed on behalf of class members who are serviced by the Cape Fear Public Utility Authority, the second expands the scope of impact, filed on behalf of class members serviced by the Brunswick County Northwest Water Treatment Plant. The first class potentially amounts to 100,000 or more members, and the latest potentially amounts to 30,000 or more members. When DuPont and Chemours dropped toxic chemicals into the Cape Fear River, knowing it would contaminate downstream water users, they negatively impacted people served by different water utilities. This suit seeks justice and fair compensation for those served by the Brunswick County Northwest Water Treatment Plant. Gary Jackson, an attorney at James Scott Farron, who is representing the plaintiff and class members in both cases, said in an email, DuPont and Chemours have owned and operated Fayetteville Works, a site along the Cape Fear River, since the 1970s. According to the complaints filed in both class actions, the defendants have been discharging Gen X into the Cape Fear River since 1980 as a byproduct of manufacturing vinyls and since 2009 as a chemical manufactured commercially. Now, in addition to those two class actions, national plaintiffs firm Cohen, Milstein, Sellers & Toll, along with litigation boutique Sussman Godfrey, are heading the charge on another class action filed against DuPont and Chemours. This is an area of litigation that has been of great importance to our firm, said Martha Geer of Cohen Milstein. The firm's Ted Leopold, co-counsel for the plaintiff in the suit, is also co-lead counsel in a class action filed on behalf of residents of Flint, Michigan, against Governor Rick Snyder and others over contamination of the city's water supply. As in Flint, the litigation has been about toxins in drinking water that become part of plumbing systems and are very difficult, if not impossible, to eradicate. Along with Cohen Milstein and Sussman Godfrey, the Dedenham Group out of Illinois and Raleigh's Whiteman Law Firm are representing the plaintiff and class members in the class action. And under the heading of technology comes the article, Outfit Offers AI and Avatars for Health Care Guidance. Raleigh-based Telehealth Services is incorporating artificial intelligence in its platform as a way to help patients better understand their condition and reduce the high cost of return visits to the hospital. The company recently rolled out its third-generation platform, iCare Navigator. The tool uses virtual health coach avatars that patients can personalize and access from the hospital. Once they leave, they can access them via their mobile devices. But it's not just for show. We've been focusing on continuing to grow our business in what has been a very challenging climate this year since the new administration, says Keith Donahue, Executive Vice President of Corporate Growth of Telerant Leasing Corporation, TLC, Telehealth's parent company. There's been a lot of uncertainty in the market, and that has trickled down to hospitals and impacted their spending. Telehealth's latest platform is designed to address a focus in healthcare on reducing costs of readmission, Donahue says. The largest driver of reducing readmission, he says, is patient education. Studies show that as much as two-thirds of information that patients are provided while admitted at healthcare facilities is forgotten once they return home, he notes. iCare Navigator has expanded features aimed at addressing this gap. First, the platform is cloud-based rather than deployed within a hospital or clinical setting, Donahue says. It's also now even more focused on patient interaction through artificial intelligence and taking cues from its use, and moves patient engagement beyond healthcare facility walls. Telehealth's current customer base spans the United States, including about half of the nation's more than 5,000 hospitals, according to Donahue. It also includes ambulatory centers, largely focused on dialysis, as well as healthcare systems and group purchasing organizations. In North Carolina, 16 hospitals use telehealth integrated platforms, including Duke Raleigh, UNC Rex, Wake Med, and Carolina's healthcare facilities. Samsung is also a longtime partner of telehealth. In its current fiscal year, TLC has a revenue target of slightly north of $200 million, he says. A significant portion of that revenue comes from telehealth. Company-wide, TLC employs about 500 people, with more than 100 in Raleigh. Telehealth is actively recruiting for graphic designers and engineers, among other positions. Telehealth was formed in 1984, and Japan's Itochu acquired TLC 5 years later. Now we turn to the On Technology and Transportation page. And under the heading of lawsuit comes the article Citrix and Ignite spar over breach of non-complete clause. Single mother and sales engineer Jessica Bell was 2.5 years into her tenure at Citrix in Raleigh when whispers of layoffs had her brushing up her resume. I can't afford to be out of work, so I was definitely looking to find other opportunities in employment elsewhere, she says. When a recruiter from Silicon Valley-based Ignite called and told her about the new sales office the firm was opening in Raleigh, she said it was the perfect fit. As she gave her notice September the 4th, however, that stack of paper she had signed when she started at Citrix came back to haunt her. Weeks into her new job at Ignite, she received a letter telling her she was in violation of a non-compete clause, and she wasn't alone. When Ignite opened its 10-person Raleigh sales office, 7 of its new employees came from Citrix, the company says. All 7 were issued threats by Citrix, says Rajesh Ram, co-founder of Ignite. It's perplexing that they go after employees who did a good job for them and dictate where they can and can't work, he says. We would rather fight this battle in the marketplace than in the courtroom. Ignite filed a lawsuit in California on October the 6th, claiming Citrix's non-compete clauses are overly broad and asking the court to deem them unenforceable. Citrix fired back October the 11th with a suit of its own, naming Ignite and the 7 former Citrix employees as defendants. That suit, filed in Florida, alleges that Ignite solicited its employees in order to engage in unfair competition with Citrix. In addition to accusing the defendants of breaching the non-compete agreements, Citrix accuses them of downloading multiple documents on their personal computers that contain trade secrets, even after their employment had ended. Those defendants, including Bell, deny wrongdoing. Ram insisted the employees were hired because they were great talent, not because they came from Citrix. As for Citrix, a spokesman says the firm has declined to comment on the pending litigation and referred Triangle Business Journal to a memorandum it had filed in support of an injunction against the 7 employees. In the document, the firm accuses Ignite of poaching employees, quote, to help Ignite launch a new office in Citrix's backyard, unquote. Diane Tindall, an attorney at Raleigh's Wyrick, Robbins, Yates, and Ponton, who has no connection to the case, cautions employees to read documentation carefully before they sign anything, even if they think a non-compete is unenforceable. They can go after you, and you might win in the long run, but it might cost you a lot of money to defend yourself, she says. And also on this page, under the heading of Rising Impact, comes the article Acme CEO CSX terminal already boosting local economy. The planned CSX intermodal terminal project has yet to break ground, but it is already boosting the expectations of some employers in eastern North Carolina. Walter Johnson, CEO of Connecticut-based Acme United Corporation, said on a recent earnings call that when purchasing its Rocky Mount site in 2013, his firm had no idea that CSX would be announcing the $270 million intermodal facility less than 3 miles away. Warehouse properties in the area are becoming much more valuable, and we look forward to having lower freight rates and better speeds of delivery when CSX opens the new operation in 2019, he told analysts. We've added 6 record sales years in a row and expect 2017 to continue that trend. Norris Tolson, CEO and President of Economic Development Recruiter Carolina's Gateway Partnership, says Acme isn't alone in celebrating CSX, which could break ground in December or January, as soon as it can get its permits together. He points to LS Tractor USA's recent announcement that it would be investing $11.5 million in new hires and facilities upgrade at its Brattleboro site. Initially, that company had planned to split its investment between multiple sites. The CSX project, however, lulled the full investment to North Carolina. Tolson says more investment, both by companies already in Rocky Mount and by new players, is expected. Now, a couple of other articles on the technology and transportation page. Under the heading of aviation, the article, Virgin America execs, SF flight could spark others. Virgin America executives in town for the brand's debut at Raleigh-Durham International Airport say San Francisco could be just the beginning. Speaking at the gate, as Virgin America's first RDU customers readied for takeoff on October the 20th, Susan Stitch, National Accounts Manager, and Nick Yancelis, Regional Director of Airports and Guest Services for the East Coast, say they're optimistic that more could be in store for the Triangle. Technically, the firm already had a presence at RDU through Alaska Airlines. The airline, which already offers Seattle service out of RDU, bought Virgin America last year. Between now and the end of 2019, you'll see the Virgin America brand around the system, Stitch said. Our goal right now is to be the premier airline of the West Coast. And that could have varying impact over the next 2 years, from adding flights in key cities such as Portland, Oregon, and San Jose, California, both of which are on RDU's nonstop wish list, to increasing the frequency of existing service. To figure out where RDU might play into that strategy, airline officials will be monitoring both Alaska's Seattle service and Virgin's San Francisco International Airport flight closely. Stitch and Yancelis are optimistic that SFO will mirror successes already seen with RDU Seattle, which could lead to more investments as the firm continues to build up awareness of Virgin America on the East Coast. In recent months, California's Virgin America brand has made several entry points in markets already represented by Alaska, said Yancelis. In addition to Raleigh, the brand recently took off out of Philadelphia, Baltimore, New Orleans, Indianapolis, and Nashville, Tennessee. He equated it to testing the waters. In the meantime, the airline is still deciding whether the SFO route will keep the Virgin America or Alaska brand as the companies transition toward a full combination. And under the heading entitled Thanks But No Thanks comes the article, RDU rejects proposals for a contested piece of land and works with Wake. As expected, the Raleigh-Durham International Airport Authority approved Wake County's proposals for 2 parcels of land it owns near I-40. But when it was time to make a decision on the controversial 105-acre Oddfellow site, board member John Kane made a motion that surprised the crowd on October 19th. I make a motion to reject all offers. The motion was approved. Both Wake Stone Corporation and the Conservation Fund had proposals to lease the property. Wake Stone wanted to use it for a quarry. The Conservation Fund planned to extend it to Umstead State Park. After the RDU Airport Authority meeting, Kane said the decision to reject both offers came after conversations with a lot of stakeholders. I think it was just in the best interest of the community and the board, he said. There's no pressure for us to do anything with that tract for now. We felt like the best thing to do was just push pause. Mike Languth, CEO of RDU Airport Authority, had said leasing the land would help fund the massive Vision 2040 project. Following the meeting, he said his team continues to push those plans forward with or without the lease revenue. We will continue to try to figure out how we fund our critical infrastructure, he said. A representative from Wake Stone Corporation declined to comment. The leasing decisions were celebrated by outdoor enthusiasts at the meeting. I'm pleased they are moving forward with Wake County, said Jean Spooner, chairwoman of the Umstead Coalition. I see this as an opportunity for some good discussions on how we can best move forward with the Odd Fellows Tract. In the meantime, appraisals are beginning on the 150 acres Wake County plans to lease for recreation. The appraisal and negotiations are expected to take 2 to 3 months. This is wonderful, and we so appreciate the RDU Authority Chair, Vice Chair, and Board for working with us to find a solution that worked for the greater community, Wake County Commission Chairman Sig Hutchinson said in an email. We appreciate their leadership and now look forward to the next steps in the process. County representatives have said to expect a final result similar to what is offered by the current Lake Crabtree County Park. Now we move to the Around the State page, and under the heading of Manufacturing comes the article, Profs, Triad has a shot at $1.6 billion auto plant. Triad officials have shipped off their bid for the $5 billion Amazon HQ2 project, but the region may have a much better shot of winning the $1.6 billion Toyota Mazda plant expected to create 4,000 jobs. That's the conclusion of two local leading professors, Andrew Broad and Keith Debbage, who believe the Triad's manufacturing workforce, combined with the region's extensive transportation infrastructure and two massive megasites, would attract the two Japanese automakers, which are teaming up to build a facility that would open by 2021 and produce 300,000 cars annually. It would be hard to imagine that this wouldn't be a very modern plant with a high degree of automation and significant demands placed on workers to understand and operate and troubleshoot different kinds of machinery and equipment. So these are going to have to be skilled workers, said Broad, senior research fellow in the UNC Greensboro Center for Business and Economic Research. I think we probably have them with a little training. The state has long vied for massive auto plants, but North Carolina has been the bridesmaid many times before. Mercedes-Benz chose Alabama over Alamance County for its plant in the 1990s, and Toyota passed over Davidson County for a facility in 2007 that went to Mississippi. In 2015, North Carolina was a runner-up to South Carolina in attracting new auto manufacturing plant projects for Volvo and Mercedes-Benz. The state also was a runner-up for the new U.S. headquarters for Mercedes-Benz that ultimately went to Atlanta. The Triad checks the boxes for land availability with the Greensboro-Randolph megasite near Liberty, containing 1,500 acres, and the nearby Chatham-Siler City advanced manufacturing site offering about 1,800 acres. We have multiple sites with water and sewer. If not at the site, forthcoming. And million-plus metro markets with a traditional manufacturing heritage, says Debbage, a geography professor at UNC Greensboro. Now moving to the news page, comes the article, Copeland, North Carolina offered monumental incentives for Amazon. A week after the Triangle submitted its official proposal for Amazon's $5 billion, 50,000 job HQ2, the top economic developer in the state hints at how big the payout might be. Commerce Secretary Tony Copeland says the state has put forth an incentives package that can be characterized as monumental. It takes advantage of everything in our authorizing environment to incent a company, he says. All that includes a transformative incentive provision in the recently passed budget aimed at companies investing more than $4 billion and creating at least 5,000 jobs in the state. The incentive allows for a 25-year JDIG term as opposed to the 12-year term typically offered. And that would be particularly important to Amazon, which would need 15 years to create 50,000 jobs, according to the RFP. The state has put forth big incentive packages before and still lost. The state offered more than $18 million to lure Mercedes-Benz in 2015, on top of a local package worth nearly $3 million. The carmaker would pick Atlanta over North Carolina, where Georgia had offered $23 million in incentives. 3 years ago, the state offered up to $2.5 billion to the Boeing company, which had considered Kinston's Global Transpark for its 8,500-job 777X aircraft manufacturing facility. And earlier this year, the state offered Apple supplier Foxconn $570 million for its $10 billion flat-screen factory. The electronics maker went with Wisconsin's $3 billion package instead, despite a last-minute rally by the North Carolina legislature to include the transformative incentive in its budget. But it's had major wins with its dollars, too, in recent years. In 2013, North Carolina won a 2,600-job investment by MetLife, which was approved for a $90 million incentives package. And just this year, two massive incentivized projects were announced for the Triangle: Credit Suisse's 1,200-job project for more than $40 million in incentives, and Infosys's 2,000-job tech hub for more than $25 million. Amazon, however, has the potential to eclipse all of the above. The company, which has confirmed it's received 238 proposals from communities across North Carolina, is reportedly being offered billions by other states. New Jersey, for example, has reportedly proposed $7 billion in tax breaks. Copeland wouldn't be specific about where North Carolina ranks in the incentives fight, saying only that total incentives will vary for each site depending on what local metros and counties are offering. He says the priority for Amazon is talent, not incentives. If you do due diligence on the company, the number one thing they're going to be looking for is talent and their ability to attract and retain talent, he says, adding that he believes North Carolina can check that box. The effort to recruit Amazon was a different dynamic than what the Commerce team is used to. The RFP was in the newspaper, so everyone is playing from the same level playing field, he says. I've never seen a collaborative approach for site selection like this in North Carolina before. As the Triangle, Triad, Charlotte, and Hickory regions were scrambling to compile their responses, the state was working up its incentives offer and supporting all four efforts, he said. When each of the metros shipped their packages last week, the boxes included a copy of the state's incentives proposal. Now we come to this week's cover story, which is entitled Finding Its Footing on the Banks of the Neuse. The first elevator in North Carolina opened in downtown Kinston Bank in 1924, and for decades it seemed the town on the banks of the Neuse was always on the rise. Kinston, fueled by the sale of tobacco and cotton, emerged as a thriving hub of eastern North Carolina. And in 1953, years before Research Triangle Park opened, DuPont opened a Kinston plant that made Dacron, the first plant to commercially produce polyester fiber. Queen Street in the heart of town throbbed with shoppers, and locals called it the Magic Mile. By 1960, Kinston's population reached 24,819, almost five times what it was at the turn of the century. Every storefront was full in downtown Kinston in the 40s and 50s, said Hyman Stadium, whose grandfather opened a men's store in downtown Kinston in 1924 that is still thriving. I have old movies on Saturdays. People were five deep on the sidewalks. Kinston was a great shopping town. But the magic stopped, and the town shriveled as it was hammered by natural and economic forces. Even as North Carolina boomed from 1960 to 2010, the population of Kinston dropped by 3,200 people, and empty storefronts became common. The population got older as young people fled. Nearly 19% of Lenoir County was 65 years old or older as of 2016. Even the local bank, the Little Bank, was acquired in 2016. Kinston now seems to have a glimmer of hope. Fueled by the opening of Chef and the Farmer Restaurant in 2006, Kinston's seeing some new businesses open and downtown starting to perk up. And in North Carolina, divided by urban and rural, Kinston's trying to find a middle path. Its challenges remain daunting: aging infrastructures and a dearth of jobs with high salaries. To the Triangle, Kinston was just a stop on the way to the beach, a place to buy a t-shirt at New Sports Shop and grab barbecue at King's before moving on. Other than that, Kinston's best-known export was a steady stream of basketball players: Charles Shackelford, Jerry Stackhouse, Reggie Bullock, and Brandon Ingram. It shipped to the ACC. Only 12.7% of county residents have a college degree, and the median household income is $34,717. The county has only 1,223 employers, according to federal records. Those harsh realities are clear in the lower home prices and empty storefronts that remain along Queen Street. One house that was on the cover of Better Homes and Gardens in 1936 is for sale at under $200,000, a fraction of what a comparable home with 3,500 square feet would sell for in Raleigh. But Kinston hopes affordable real estate, combined with a pro-business attitude and a flourishing art scene, can rekindle hope. "This Queen Street is about half vacant," says B.J. Murphy, mayor since 2009, as he looks out the window from a deli to the street behind him. "It's prime commercial real estate. 10 years ago, this was not a place where you wanted to buy a building. But over the next 5 years, it will be gobbled up." One believer is Gaurav Patel, best known for his 6 restaurants in the Triangle, including Mura in North Hills and Cameron Bar and Grill in Cameron Village, that operate under the Echelon Experiences banner. When he and his business partners, Kerry Joshi and Mark Mullins, were looking for a place to establish a vodka operation, they stumbled into an unlikely opportunity about 82 miles east of Raleigh. "When we started coming here, people were like, 'Where's Kinston?'" Joshi says, recalling their arrival in October of 2016. Patel and Joshi wanted a home for their new concept, Social House Vodka. A key driver: keep fixed costs low. They looked in downtown Kinston and didn't find a fit. Toward the end of their trip, their host mentioned an abandoned power plant near the Neuse. "We looked at it and we were like, 'This is it,'" Joshi says. The entrepreneurs got the building for $500 and also piled up grants for $350,000, largely because of the decision to locate in a distressed place. But still, Joshi says, the investors have put $3 million of their own cash into the business. The distillery benefits from having all the corn they need only 8 miles away, and Joshi says sales have been very brisk for the vodka, which sells for $19.95. In North Carolina, the distiller's sale price is roughly half the sale price in ABC stores. They're producing 28,000 9-liter cases per year and plan to ramp up to 120,000 cases per year. Right now, the company, Social Beverage Company, has 6 employees. Patel sees growing that to 38 in 5 years. The entrepreneurs love the eagerness of the community to help. One of the owners of longtime restaurant Lovick's told them to call if they ever ran short of staff help. They use rooms at Lenore Community College for job interviews. And Wilbur King, whose family started the famous barbecue restaurant in 1947, told them the history of the town. When Social House Vodka had its grand opening, they expected a small crowd. Instead, 200 people showed up. "The city is definitely pro-business," Joshi says. "In Raleigh, a rezoning can take 9 months to a year. Here, 2 weeks." That small-town feel is evident in the Queen Street Cafe as Mayor Murphy greets customers while in line for lunch. "Hello, doctor," Murphy says, patting a friend on the back. A woman tells him, "I'm voting for you." And with the November election nearing, he answers, "I appreciate it." The Queen Street Cafe, owned by Lorraine Tolston, the sister of Vivian Howard of Chef and Farmer fame, draws an affluent crowd that could easily be found in a town like Chapel Hill or Cary. But outside the windows are the challenges the city faces. Sewer pipes are 100 years old. Half of the buildings on the street remain empty. Murphy believes diagonal parking may make Queen Street more friendly to pedestrians and encourage more business. We have an opportunity to entice economic development here, he says. Murphy is a native son who no one could have blamed for leaving. His mother was murdered in an incident at a convenience store when Murphy was a child. But he has remained. He started his own marketing firm and is now convinced Kinston has to control its own narrative. He knows the challenges. The DuPont plant that once employed thousands has maybe 100 employees now. The shirt factories that had large swaths of employees are gone. And what was once a vast agricultural industry has been largely reduced. And in 1999, Hurricane Floyd swelled the waters of the news, destroying hundreds of homes. To survive, Murphy says, we've had to diversify our economy. Part of that, he says, is building a microeconomy that can replace some of the lost jobs, that is, building around smaller employers that the town may have a better chance of attracting. A big employer would help as well, of course, and he sees fresh hope for the Global Transpark, the massive and largely empty airfield outside Kinston that employs former Greenville Mayor Alan Thomas as executive director. And the community brand, as he calls it, is more positive, thanks to Chef and the Farmer, and the efforts of local entrepreneur Stephen Hill to rebuild downtown. It's also helped, he says, that the community has been determined to help businesses such as Social House Vodka find a way to start and succeed. When it comes to working with businesses, Murphy says, we've got to find ways to say yes, not no. If Vivian Howard of Chef and the Farmer sparked the start of Kinston's revitalization, then Hill stoked the flame. In 2008, 2 years after Howard opened her restaurant a block off Queen Street, Hill and his son-in-law opened Mother Earth Brewing, a craft brewery that he put in what he says has been the ugliest building in town. The brewery has a hip, modern feel and produced 7,000 barrels of beer in 2016. Hill's the sort of smart, driven, and down-to-earth person you find in towns such as Kinston, perfectly at ease wearing shorts and flip-flops to an interview, and installing a slide in Mother Earth so the employees can slide from the second floor to the first. Hill's family owns Kinston-based Hillco Limited, which provides nursing centers for the elderly, and was founded by his father. But Hill's interests have broadened to include a keen interest in the arts. He's now chairman of the board of the North Carolina Arts Council and a determination to revive Kinston. He says he saw what a commitment to the arts can do for a community when traveling the states with the Arts Council. We're trying to rebuild Kinston based on the arts, culinary arts, visual arts, metalworks, glassblowers. We're building around that, he says. We're making it a place where people want to live and enjoy themselves. Hill lured Raleigh artist Thomas Sayre to do a massive piece on the edge of downtown called Flue, an homage to the tobacco warehouses that once marked the area. It's part of an impressive Kinston Park public art trail that includes dozens of pieces across the city. I've seen what art does for a city, Hill says. It's just a vision. Large city, small city, it's something you can do. Hill has purchased and upgraded several buildings downtown. The former bank, which he says includes paperwork that's certifying it has the state's first elevator, is now the O'Neill, a swank hotel with a lush marble main room and seven guest rooms above. Hill and his wife live on the top floor and have rooftop patio with stunning views of Queen Street. Hill says the building was empty for years, and inside, he adds, there was nothing but pigeons. He turned an old motel into the retro-looking Mother Earth Motor Lodge and led the push to create an arts district in a dilapidated neighborhood, a part of town now spruced up with brightly painted buildings. It took time, and it's still in the process, Hill says, of changing Kinston. It takes time. It's not quick enough. There's still a long way to go. Perhaps no one has a longer view of Kinston's ebbs and flows than Hyman Stadium. The affable stadium, wearing sporty suspenders on a recent day and greeting customers with a smiling, "How are you?" has watched the changes firsthand. He remembers how the Jewish temple was full of families, many of whom ran businesses across eastern North Carolina. Now there aren't enough members for a rabbi. His store retains a bit of a 1950s feel, with suits and ties fit for Cary Grant. but Stadium says the business has survived and flourished by changing with the times. It added more big and tall clothes, cut back on furniture for infants when the recession hit, and even expanded into new spaces. Asked if he ever considered relocating, he says, "We just love our town. It never occurred to us. We've had to change, but business has always been good, and now it's better than in years." The chef and the farmer has been instrumental in bringing people back to Kinston, Stadium says. "I go home at night and see cars from everywhere." He's grateful and not surprised. "We've always had confidence in our town," he says. And in association with this cover story comes a little blurb on Lenoir County up close. So here's some stats. The 2016 population was 57,307, with the percentage of population 65 or older at 18.8%. The white population, 56%. The African-American population, 41%. Building permits in 2016, 112. Median value of owner-occupied homes, 92,500. Population age 25 or older with college degree, 12.7%. Median household income in 2015 dollars is $34,717. The population in poverty, 22.7%, and the total employers, 1,223. Now, also under the heading of the cover story comes the article Underutilized. And the article's name is Decades Later, Global Trans Park Still Searches for Its Sea Legs. About an hour and a half from Raleigh, tucked behind cotton fields, lies Kinston's Global Trans Park, a 2,500-acre, $200 million bet by the state. The park, developed in the 1990s around the state's second-largest airstrip, was to attract the next Boeing or Airbus and bring thousands of jobs. Today, most of its fields are vacant. While a 650,000-square-foot Spirit Aerosystems complex is pumping out wing parts and fuselages for Airbus jets, a major airplane assembler has yet to sign on, and the losses keep coming. One of its newer tenants, North State Aviation, closed last year. A railroad spur, constructed as part of the deal to lure Spirit, has yet to be used. For North Carolina taxpayers, the dole-out to support the park continues, as another $6.3 million left the state coffers last year. Overall, the state has invested around $225 million since its inception in 1992. But park proponents have renewed hope for a turnaround. Executive Director Alan Thomas, who recently left his role as Greenville mayor to lead GTP, says he plans to break old habits, going back to square one in recruiting. "I've been given an aggressive timeline," Thomas says. "I'm an aggressive guy." By March, outside consultants will have assessed what the park has, what it needs to go after, and what we just need to stay the heck out of, he adds. Unlike predecessors who cast a wide net, Thomas promises a focused approach, and he's not waiting on the full report before getting started. Already, multiple tenants are making offers on property vacated by North State. GTP is on the short list for another unnamed project, he says. The ingredients are there. Members of the GTP Foundation Board agree. Hugh Overholt, a retired Major General and board member, says the park has everything you could want in terms of facilities. But it also has to lure projects with the livability of its surrounding communities. Perception matters, he says. It's, "Do you want to live in Kinston, North Carolina, or do you want to live in Charleston?" he says. Thomas says a big asset is the proximity to local military bases that pump out talent trained for aerospace. Gregory Kurian, director of heavy maintenance for Mountain Air Cargo, which maintains a fleet of 60 jets for FedEx at GTP, says half of its 60 employees are veterans. Others come from specialized aerospace training programs at community colleges in nearby Wayne and Craven counties. Spirit, which has 600 employees in the park, is also taking advantage of the military talent pool, says John Beilman, its director of operations. In the beginning, much of its talent came from Spirit's home base in Wichita, Kansas. Now more than 90% of new hires are from North Carolina. Today, Spirit pumps out more than 9 massive fuselages for Airbus jets each month, triple from 18 months ago. GTP Thomas says the region's military influx heightens the stakes further. World-class talent's being created at the bases, and to keep it, the state needs to create opportunities for veterans and also for their families. I want them to be able to raise their kids here. Have a world-class technology job if that's what they want, he says. Bill Bryan, chairman of Mount Olive Pickles and GTP Foundation board member, agrees. If Eastern North Carolina doesn't do well, the state isn't going to do well, he says. Board member David Ward, former head of the Research Triangle Foundation, says, it hasn't done as greatly as I'd hoped, but better days are here to come. Now, this week's Executive Voice column features Joyce Weiland. The article's entitled, Fostering Lively Culture Pays Off for SoftPro. Raleigh-based SoftPro is a regular winner of Triangle Business Journal's Best Places to Work Awards, landing on the list in 2017 for the sixth straight year. At the helm is Joyce Weiland, who rose up from the ranks and now leads the company as president. Here, Weiland reflects on her rise, why the company has prospered, and what's next for a company that looks to foster a lively culture. So here's the Q&A. How did SoftPro get started, and what has sparked its growth? SoftPro is the leading real estate closing and title insurance software company in the country. The founder, Lauren Harrell, developed the software in 1984 to solve the need of his attorney friends who were in search of a software product that would simplify real estate closings. Since then, SoftPro has continued to expand the product suite to service title companies and attorneys nationwide. You started there as a sales consultant in 1994. How big was the company then? I started in sales, but at the time we were a small company with under 20 employees. Even though I was technically in sales, at that time every team member did whatever was necessary, whether it be support, developing documents, or even just helping with actual shipment of the product. It was a great way to learn how our software runs and the teamwork that's required to have a successful company. I distinctly remember the team spirit of SoftPro even in the beginning. Everyone at SoftPro truly helped each other out for the benefit of the customer, and this still holds true today. What advice do you have for others who want to move up in their companies? We have a saying that you interview for your job here every day. I tell people that if you take initiative and are willing to go the extra mile to help either customers or your teammates, you will be successful. At the end of the day, if you put your ego aside and just work hard, the right opportunities will present themselves. Another key component is the ability to communicate with your manager and let them know your goals. You have to be actively involved in your career's possession and not expect something to be handed to you. So what was the biggest challenge you faced when you moved from COO to president? We were acquired in 2001, so at the time the challenge was leading the company in its transition from a privately held company to a public company. We were also in a position where we were growing very quickly. However, we worked hard to make sure the culture didn't change as the heartbeat of the organization. When you were named one of our 40 under 40 winners in 2011, you said your goal in 5 years was for SoftPro to be, quote, the only viable choice remaining in the real estate and title insurance industry, unquote. How is that going? Our market share is the strongest it's ever been. There were some competitors that didn't fare very well during the huge regulatory changes our industry just faced in 2015. SoftPro was positioned to deliver updates on our products for our customers that reflected these regulatory changes. We've also developed an integration platform that allows our customers to exchange data with the vendor partners that they use on a day-to-day basis. In 2018, our focus is to deliver a software-as-a-service version to our customer base. You now have 265 employees in the Triangle and recently added 86 new employees and contracts. What's driving this growth? We started new divisions within the company, such as professional services and custom development offerings for our customer base. We're also launching our software as a service model. We want to be a one-stop shop for our industry with products and services available that it needs. Where are most of SoftPro's clients based? Our customers are nationwide. We even have some in Guam. Is there a book you read that made a particular impact on you? Delivering Happiness by Tony Say. This book completely resonated with me, giving my passion for providing superior customer service. in addition to recognize the importance of culture in any organization. You've said your mother was your hero. How did she inspire you? My mother came to this country from France in the early 70s. She was a teacher in France and wanted to continue to teach once she came to the U.S. She set out to get her bachelor's and master's degrees from the University of Arizona. She achieved this in under 4 years while raising a family and having little knowledge of the English language. Most people I know can't finish their bachelor's in 4 years, and they know English. She ended up ranking as one of the top French professors in the country. And lastly, for women who aspire to lead companies, what advice do you have? Stay true to your values. Set your goals and conquer them, and don't obsess on the equality factor. My values are simple. Treat people fairly, be humble in both good and challenging times, and have the back of the people on your team. Leadership isn't about ego. It's about staying true to your values. Finally, leadership is about service. It really all comes back to that for me. And as we approach the end of the program this week, comes two articles from the Viewpoint page. The first is a guest opinion, and it's entitled, Lighting the Way for Amazon in the State. As a lifelong North Carolinian, I've always been impressed by our collaborative spirit of our state, diverse people, ideas, and resources coming together to enhance the vitality of our communities. It's this collaboration and innovation that make Duke Energy proud to serve communities and customers here. And it's this collaboration and innovation that make North Carolina a great fit for Amazon's HQ2 project. Amazon empowers people across the world to seize the opportunities of today's digital economy. We know that Amazon would thrive here in North Carolina, not just in the business sense, but as part of the community. And we want to make sure they have the right tools to succeed. For us, that means providing affordable, reliable, and increasingly clean energy. For the past 100 years, Duke Energy has grown along with North Carolina and powered its economic transformation, from agriculture and textiles to advanced manufacturing, healthcare, and high-tech sectors. And we're preparing to serve our state for the next century. That's why we're committed to transforming the energy future to benefit all North Carolinians. We're working hard to generate cleaner energy, invest in a smarter grid, and offer customers more choice in how they receive information from us and help them manage their energy use in real time. This transition has helped lead our state to become number 2 in the nation for overall solar energy, right behind California. North Carolina's national leadership in solar development is a multifaceted story and is one part of Duke Energy's effort to build a smarter grid with a diverse energy mix. For example, the state recently adopted the Competitive Energy Solutions for North Carolina law, an effort that brought together a diverse set of stakeholders to position North Carolina for continued solar growth. We've also announced our Power Forward Carolinas initiative, a bold plan to invest $13 billion over the next 10 years to upgrade and strengthen our energy grid here in North Carolina. This initiative will enhance quality of life and lay the foundation for economic development by greatly improving reliability, providing strong defenses against cyber attacks and physical threats, providing customers more information and control, and balancing the sustainable integration of renewables and clean energy. Implementing the plan will also create thousands of good jobs across the state. Just as we work with our existing customers and communities, we want to help light the way for Amazon to succeed in North Carolina. And this viewpoint is written by David Fountain, North Carolina President of Duke Energy Corporation. And our final article from the editor's notebook is Forget Amazon, Step Up for These Guys. An interesting story emerged this week relating to North Carolina's bid to land Amazon's HQ2 project. Commerce Secretary Tony Copeland said the state's incentive package for Amazon is nothing short of monumental. North Carolina's chances of landing the project are better than most states, but the Tar Heel State is definitely behind a handful of competitors. If the Triangle gets the project, it likely will be the biggest economic development coup for the area since the formation of the Research Triangle Park in the late 50s, and that took several years to develop into a recruitment juggernaut. All this Amazon talk has thrown two significant deals on the back burner, the sale of the Carolina Hurricanes Hockey Club and the North Carolina Football Club's bid to land the Major League Soccer franchise. From what I hear, both deals require significant work to put them back on track. That's where the corporate community needs to step in. As far as the MLS bid goes, Nashville, Tennessee recently announced that 90% of the $250 million plus deal will be financed privately, mostly by paying back to the local government the bonds that will be floated initially. As for the NHL deal, sports lawyer Chuck Greenberg was forming a syndicate of local and national investor groups along with some $100 million line of credit from the National Hockey League to structure the deal. For now, it looks like he's struggling to raise the local dollars, despite full support from O. Temple Sloan, Jim Goodman, and a few other notable business leaders. Let me just say, if Canes owner Pete Carmanos decides to move the NHL franchise, or if Steve Malik is unable to land an MLS franchise to Raleigh, that will have a far more damaging effect on the Triangle brand than losing Amazon HQ. And while some may think sports business and its economic ripple is far overstated, a city without a major league franchise simply is a minor league town. To me, keeping the NHL team here and luring another major league professional sports franchise is critical for the community's brand. Because if we fail to nail either one of these down, we will slide further down in Amazon's eyes and everyone that comes after them. Frequent listeners will know that the Triangle Business Journal always offers a business survey pulse. This week is no different. And the question is, should North Carolina offer Amazon a record incentives package for HQ2? There were only 151 responses to this question, but 75% said yes. And, of course, the balance, 25%, said no. And in a couple of promotions in the area, Lori Sykes, Senior Manager of Lead Tax. Lori's responsible for serving the tax needs of large corporations within the specialty finance, life sciences, and professional services industry. And a promotion for Todd Rowe, Wealth Advisor for RSM US LLP, responsible for helping successful individuals and families make sound financial decisions. Well, that music means we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Alton Banks, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Once again, that's 919-832-5138.